Today we want to talk about, does God exist? The proofs that God exists. Now, if you talk to different people, some people are adamant that God exists. Some people are adamant that God does not exist. And when you listen to their reasoning for their arguments, most of the time, for both sides, you will get arguments that are very subjective. What is that? Does anybody know what that means, subjective? What is that? Somebody give me a definition of what that terminology means. As opposed to being objective. Yes?
Slanted toward their opinion and ideas.
Okay, that's part of it. Let's define it this way. What is objective, which is the opposite of that? Patty?
Unbiased.
Unbiased, okay.
I think it's something that's verifiable outside of your own opinion.
Okay, it's something that is verifiable outside of your own personal experience. That is, I can verify it, you can verify it, you can verify it. Everybody, if they test it in the same way, will come out with the same result. But something that is subjective is based on something that's personal to you. Now, you may have seen bumper stickers that say, I know God is real, I talked to him this morning. Anybody ever see that bumper sticker? Is that objective evidence for God or subjective evidence for God? Yes, because see, somebody else can say, well, that's not evidence that God exists. That's evidence that you're nuts.
Yeah.
Right? Because there are people in Nut House who are talking to people who don't exist all the time. Isn't that right? That's not objective evidence. Objective evidence is evidence that is concrete, that if everyone looks at it using proper logic, they should always come to the same conclusion if they investigate it properly. Now, this is why when you go to court, if somebody goes to court, they use rules for evidence that's to be admitted in court so that the decisions that the court makes will always be based on objective thing, not subjective, not things that are just your opinion. That's why they don't allow hearsay in a courtroom and things like that, right? You heard somebody say that. Well, how do you know that that person told the truth who said that to you? See, that person is not here to interrogate them. So that's subjective evidence. By the way, if you see one of those bumper stickers on somebody's car that says, I know God is real, I talked to him this morning, please peel it off and throw it away for me, okay? Because I think it does more damage than it does good. If you're trying to appeal to somebody who is looking for evidence for God, that's laughable. It's laughable. Now, it might be convincing to you. Your prayer life, the fact that God has responded to your prayers, and you know he's there because of your interaction with him, that's great for you personally, but that's not the kind of evidence you want to put out there to people that God exists. They need something that's concrete, something that is verifiable. There's nothing wrong with that, but the purpose, it's supposed to be showing someone else that God is real and evidence that God is real, and it's doing it the wrong way. That's the problem. There's nothing wrong with giving personal testimony of your faith. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you're appealing to somebody to show them that God is real, you need to use objective means, not subjective means. If you're simply confirming your own faith, then subjective means are perfectly fine. That's all I'm saying. So in this class, what we're trying to do is we're trying to look at things objectively. And remember, we said at the beginning of the class that one of the reasons for this class is to help equip you to deal with people out there who are not Christians. How to testify to the existence of God, to your faith, to who God is, and all that. So what we're going to be looking at today is some objective ways that we can know that God is real. And if other people will use these same methodologies, they should come to the same conclusions if they use proper logic. Let's look at what I would say are the three most compelling objective ways to show that God exists. Number one is what is called the first cause argument. It's also called the cosmological argument. Essentially, what this says is that everything that began to exist must have a cause greater than itself. And this is a statement of philosophy that is accepted across the board because it's true in everything that we observe. This pew right here, in fact, all these pews in this room have a cause greater than themselves. Isn't that right? Somebody cut down a bunch of oak trees. Somebody planed those things into boards. And somebody assembled that. Somebody finished it. Somebody put a cushion on it. That pew didn't just happen of its own accord. That pew has a cause greater than itself. Isn't that right? Everything we see that began to exist, if it had a beginning, then it has a greater cause. Something greater than itself has caused it. Now, we know that the universe began to exist. Therefore, there must be a cause outside of and greater than the universe that caused the universe to be here. Now, how do we know that the universe began to exist? See, if you go back, presently, that's not anything you really need to prove, because scientists will agree. In fact, the Big Bang Theory is a theory designed to try to explain the origin of the universe. And all scientists today believe that the universe had an origin. Now, if you go back centuries, especially back to some of the Greek philosophers, some of them taught that the universe has always been here. It's always been here. But other philosophers argued that that's impossible, and they use this argument here. The argument is essentially that anything that changes has to have a beginning. Anything that changes, anything that is not static, anything. Now, we look at the universe, and what do we see? We see planets in motion. We see the sun and the moon, which appear to be in motion. Actually, the earth is in motion. But either way, there's motion going on. Part of the argument was, if there is motion, then something had to cause the motion. Isn't that right? Something had to put it in motion. Things don't, you know, if you put a rock on the ground, that rock is never going to move unless something moves it. Isn't that right? Something's got to move it. I mean, it could be a giant tornado could move it, or somebody could pick it up and move it, or whatever. But if it's in motion, something has put it in motion, something else greater than itself. So there's the argument of first cause is that everything that began to exist and everything that is in motion, or processes that are in motion, processes like the earth revolving around the sun, the moon revolving around the earth, whatever these processes are, something had to cause those processes to begin, and that something has to be greater than the thing that we're talking about. Now, when you take the whole universe, this argument absolutely requires, from logic, it requires that there must be a first cause that is greater than the universe itself in order to cause the universe to be here and also to put things in motion in the universe. Now, that argument has never been refuted. It is absolutely essential to a logical way of thinking. Now, Justin Martyr was one of the early church fathers. And if you read his dialogue with Trypho, which is, he had a sort of a philosophical discussion with a Jew named Trypho, an unbelieving Jew. In the opening chapters of that, if you ever get a hold of it, you can read it online, but if you ever want to read it, there's a discussion between Trypho before he became a Christian. He's telling the story of him becoming a Christian. And prior to that, he was a follower of various Greek philosophical schools, the last of those being from Plato. He followed Plato's ideas. And then he encountered a Christian man. And by the way, this is only about less than 100 years after Christ's crucifixion that he lived and this happened. He encountered an older Christian gentleman, and he had a philosophical discussion with this older Christian gentleman. And one of the things they discussed was this idea of first cause. And the Christian introduced the idea of first cause to Justin and proved to Justin that there must be one ultimate, unchanging, eternal cause, first cause for the creation. That there's no way around that argument, and that is greater than the creation itself, greater than the universe and physical matter and energy and all the things that we see in here. So number one argument is first cause. Something started this. Now, if you talk to modern evolutionists, those who deny God, they have their in the beginning story just like the Bible does. If you open to Genesis 1:1, it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And then it goes on to talk about how he did that. If you read a science book, they have their in the beginning story too. It goes like this. In the beginning, there was nothing. Nothing exploded into everything. That's pretty much it. Some of them don't go quite that far. They'll say, in the beginning, there was the singularity. The singularity supposedly is all the matter and energy in the universe was compressed into the spot that's no bigger than the period on my paper right here. Okay, now if you believe that, I got some great waterfront property that you might want to buy that's a little bit west of here, about 100 miles west of here. I'll sell it to you really cheap. All the matter in the universe was in some little spot. Well, first of all, what caused it to explode into everything? Second of all, where did that singularity come from? It needs a first cause. It needs a first cause. Secondly, it needs something to set the processes in motion if all this stuff exploded out of this little period. Now, it's absurd. And these are the people who say that belief in God is absurd. And they believe in a little period that exploded into everything, and they can't explain how that little period got here to begin with. It's foolishness. It really is foolishness. It's illogical, but yet they cling to it because the alternative is there's a creator, and they don't want to believe in a creator. All right, well, that's the first argument, and you should use that argument. When you talk to people who want evidence for God, it's an argument from logic and philosophy that is not refutable. Now, it doesn't tell us who this God is. All it tells us is there is a first cause. It doesn't say it's an intelligent cause. It doesn't say, you know, that it's not just, it's something outside of this universe is all that this argument demonstrates. That there is something besides this universe that began this universe and that set this universe in motion. All right? Now, it doesn't say anything about who he is or what his nature is or even if he's conscious of anything. But that argument then can be addressed with the next one, which is the complexity argument or the argument from intelligent design. This is the number two argument you should use. The fact is, the universe is so complex. Not just the planets and the stars and chemistry and all that stuff. But really, if you want to zero it down to the most profound and weighty argument of all when it comes to intelligent design, it's certainly got to be biology. It's got to be life itself. Life itself is so complex. And the more that science discovers about life, the more impossible it is that it just happens spontaneously. Now, the best evidence for that is the DNA. You guys know what DNA is, right? Most of you know what DNA is. DNA is in every cell, in every living creature, even including plants, there is a computer code, for lack of a better term. There is a code. It is a series of messages, if you want, that instructs the cells how to do what they have to do, including how to reproduce, how to do this. Now, the cells also have within them the ability to read the code and interpret the code and process the code and then carry out the instructions in the code. Now, they've discovered this DNA and they found out how that you can alter it in order to actually cause living beings to change. Right? You can alter it. Now, it's really equivalent to a computer program and the hardware to support the computer program. Now, a computer program is itself information, right? All it is stored information. It's a long list of instructions telling the hardware what to do and how to do it, right? That's all it is. You ever seen a player piano? Anybody ever seen a player piano? It's got a roll, it's got a paper roll on it with all the holes punched in it. Well, all those holes do is instruct the piano which keys to push, right? It's got a little mechanism that reads those holes and pushes the keys at the right time. So in order for that thing to work, you've got to have the roll, which is the information, and then you've got to have a player piano that will play it. And the two are designed to go together. They have to be designed to go together. Well, that's what we have in every cell of every living creature, is we have this DNA computer code information, and we have the mechanisms to interpret the code and carry out the code. There's been a lot of good work done on this by some of the creation ministries, including Answers in Genesis is a good one. And they've got some videos and things like that, which actually shows how complex one single cell really is. And it's absolutely, it's amazing. One cell in your body is more complex than a whole city, including all the public works and the plumbing and the electrical and all the buildings and all that stuff. One little cell in your body is more complex than that. And to say that that happens spontaneously and that all of this works together, you know, if you take a computer code, if you corrupt it just a little bit, what happens? Your computer crashes. Yeah, you get the blue screen of death, which you used to get with Microsoft anyway. Right? You still have, you got an older version, you probably run an XP. The blue screen of death, right? And then everything crashes and you got to shut the thing down and reboot it. You know, just a little bit of corrupted data causes complete havoc and all that. But you've got all of these living cells that are functioning together over an entire lifetime, and they've got the ability to repair themselves when things go wrong. I mean, your immune system is incredible. Your reproductive system is incredible. How can that happen by chance? Because evolution demands, how can Steve, you tell me, how can reproduction happen in evolution? It's impossible, right? Because what does evolution require? Reproduction. In order for things to evolve, supposedly, according to evolution, there has to be corrupted information, and then the next generation, that's passed on to the next generation, passed on to the next generation, passed on to the next generation. Well, it's supposedly this mutations that are passed on that supposedly cause the mechanism to get better and better, which is ridiculous because we know mutations cause them to get worse and worse. And this is supposedly causing evolution, but the problem is it requires reproduction in order for evolution to take place, if evolution were true. So what you have then is a circular argument. You have a circular argument. You're saying, well, evolution happens because of reproduction, but it can't happen. How did reproduction start? Then see, by evolution. Well, I'm sorry,
It means that that first magical moment when the pond slime became something that was living.
Yep.
It was magically, I don't even know what the word was, not created, obviously, but it actually had the ability to reproduce from the very beginning.
It had to have it to be
something that's able to produce.
It can't evolve until it reproduces. That's the point. It can't evolve until it reproduces. Then how did reproduction come about? See, you end up with a logical circle, a circular argument. Well, this happened because of this. Well, then why did that happen? Well, because of that. Well, it can't be that way. You have to have a first cause and a sequence of things. It's the chicken and the egg thing. Yeah, right. See, what you have is these are logical inconsistencies. Evolutionists cannot explain how life began. They cannot explain it. It's impossible to explain because it's absolutely illogical that it just spontaneously happened. All right. Again, you have to have a first cause greater than the thing that is being caused. All right. So we have complexity, intelligent design. All of this shows that what this shows is not only is there a first cause, but this first cause is extraordinarily intelligent. All right, because DNA itself is knowledge. It's knowledge that's recorded. It's instructions that are recorded into the cell of every body. And knowledge doesn't just happen. knowledge needs an intelligent mind in order to produce. So what we've learned is that the first argument, first cause, is there's something powerful, there's something outside of the creation that is a first cause. In the complexity argument, we learn that this first cause must be extraordinarily intelligent, far beyond anything we can imagine in our mind. Okay, intelligence, and also power, because the ability not only to design it, but to implement it and make it continue to reproduce itself is staggering.
And also vast, because to be able to design a universe that is infinite in size requires a designer that is aware of
every little thing.
Not only in the most intricately minute details of biological life, but also the vast universe. It's an entity that has to be aware of the extremes of the universe, because the extremes of the universe work in an orderly fashion.
That's right. Everything interacts with everything else.
That's right. This is a being that can look into the subatomic world and also into the vast universe and be aware of both simultaneously.
Right. And how everything fits together. Just look at plants and animals. Supposedly, animals evolved and plants evolved. But what's amazing is that the food for the animals, or for us, comes from these plants. How is it that those plants just happen to evolve in such a way that didn't benefit them at all, but benefits us? How does that cause the corn, you know, some pond scum, to evolve into corn stalks and corn kernels that is good for us to eat? The theory of evolution requires that whatever mutations happen to that organism, that only the good mutations survive and then the bad mutations die off, right? Supposedly, that's what it is. But see, what you have is you've got plants supposedly evolving and animals up to people supposedly evolving, and the food for the people, there it is, magically appears. It doesn't benefit the plant, but it benefits us. See, it doesn't follow the rules. When you think about evolution. But anyway, there's all kinds of arguments against evolution, but enough on that subject. Now, let's look at the third argument that you should use. And this is probably one of the most important, if not the most important, argument. And that is that predictive prophecy demands a supernatural source. See, the people who deny the existence of God are what we would call naturalists. They believe that everything that happens is caused simply by physical processes and randomness. All right? Just randomness. If we can show that things are being guided and are not random, then we have shown that there's a mind behind all this. All right? Now, that's what predictive prophecy does. Predictive prophecy shows us that there is a mind that is guiding human history. All right, did you get that? There's a mind and a power that is guiding human history. Now, when we say predictive prophecy, we're talking about the fact that in the Bible, and the prophets in the Bible have come claiming to be speaking for God by His Spirit, and they have made predictions about the long-term future, mostly related to the nation of Israel, but also related to some of the judgments that were going to happen to Israel's enemies, and the coming of Christ, His crucifixion, His second coming, His kingdom. Many things have been prophesied, hundreds and hundreds, and in some cases thousands of years before they actually happened, and they have happened exactly as they were prophesied. Now, we can give lots of examples of that, and we are going to look at examples of that in a future class. We're going to spend some time on that. But that should be in your little tool bag your little arsenal for helping convince the skeptic that God exists, that should be like your crescent wrench. Anybody know what a crescent wrench is? Crescent wrench is that wrench that is adjustable, that will fit any size. All right, you twirl the little knob there and it gets bigger and smaller. Yeah, George.
Tim, you know, there's a dual purpose for Darwin's theory of evolution. Because Darwin wasn't only an evolutionist, but he was also a eugenicist. And in fact, there is intermarriage between his family line and Thomas Malthus, who was the first eugenicist.
You need to explain to them what a eugenicist is.
A eugenicist is someone who believes that in the superiority of certain races. The word means good birth. So there's good births, there's bad births. Thomas Malthus was the first, and a eugenicist believes that in order for the good races to evolve, that the inferior races have to be eliminated. And Thomas Malthus was an Anglican priest. And he also believed that because of his primary concern was that the food production in the world was not able to sustain the growing population. And so that the human population needed to be reduced in order so that the good species, the good race, could continue to live at the expense of the bad ones. Well, the actual original title of Darwin's book, Origin of Species, is The Origin of Species and the Survivability of the Preferred Races. Hmm. That was, and Darwin was a eugenicist. And so Darwin, like Malthus, believed that the Aboriginal races and the black races were not as evolved as the Aryan races. And so they, and also the poor white as well. And so they took it to Malthus. This is back in the mid-1700s. He was instrumental in designing the poor neighborhoods to be built in swamplands and in areas and in the English bogs that would promote disease among the poor so that the poor would die at a younger age. All right, this is a Anglican priest. That's why, you know, when people get, when supposedly those who are associated with God in their profession turn away from God, they're the worst, the absolute worst. So anyhow, Darwin was also a eugenicist, and his book was to explain the logic and the reasoning in defense of eugenics as well. So it had a dual purpose. Now it became very unpopular. And so the title was dropped, and it only became The Origin of Species. All right, but the danger is that the second part of that book is now become popular in the realms of academia. Yeah. You know, where it is being taught again that the human race needs to be eliminated to a great extent in order for the cream of the crop to rise to the top. And that's why you have people that are in high, high positions who are not only promoting but are actively involved in the genocide of third world populations, respectable people, and that are contributing, you know, the Warren Buffetts, the Bill Gates, the Ted Turners, who are contributing hundreds of millions of dollars towards the elimination of sectors of the human race because they are eugenicists as well. And yep, this is being taught to high school students.
Yeah.
Right? My son, in one of his high school books, the benefits of eliminating undesirable infants and races was part, and he was part of a UN program. He an IB student. And this was the kind of stuff that was taught to these kids because these were the creme de la creme, and they wanted to indoctrinate them with this mindset. And so it's coming back. And so when we talk about evolution, it's also important to note that
where it leads.
This was also the other agenda, yeah. Which is now coming back with a vengeance.
Yeah, eugenics has manifested itself in various ways, including Hitler, extermination of the... You know, the Jews and all that was part of that same kind of philosophy. If it wasn't for Darwin, Hitler wouldn't have done the things that he did. But they also believed in sterilizing these so-called undesirable bloodlines, people who, you know, like people who were retarded, people who, you know, just weren't all that intelligent, or certain undesirable races that they had in mind. According to them, that were undesirable. And they'd sterilize them, not kill them, so they couldn't reproduce. And then, supposedly over time, if you kept doing this, then this Aryan race, you know, the supposedly the elites would, you know, only be the ones reproducing, and therefore, you know, they would change the population of the world.
We started it before him in the United States. We were sterilizing, and in fact, the last person who was sterilized in the United States was in 1972. That's when it was totally eliminated. That short ago, but it started either 1927 or 1907. I forget. In Indiana, and Hitler he learned from it. And actually, he credits eugenicists in the United States for showing him the process of how to carry on his program of purifying the races. But in this country, this is why, you know, Planned Parenthood and all that, without getting into all that, that was part of it. In this country, the sterilization of families who had, say, criminal history, or epilepsy, or some other types of diseases, they were forcibly sterilized. In fact, there's a movie that came out in the 30s or 40s that, and I forget the name of the movie, it depicts that in this country. And in fact, the Supreme Court also supported it, because the case went to the Supreme Court, and it was Oliver Wendell Holmes who said that we need to get rid of these imbeciles in support of sterilization in this country. So anyhow, it's coming back with a vengeance, and so this is what we're dealing with. We're not just dealing with abstract philosophical ideas. We're dealing with people who are taking it to its logical conclusion.
Yep.
Some people should live, some people should die, because we want to evolve into the super race that we should be.
It's demonic.
Yep.
The whole thing is demonic. From Darwin's theory all the way through, all of its logical implications is demonic. God says that we have all of us are from one race. Isn't that right? He has from one race established all the nations of the earth, the Bible says. So, and all of us are God's creation, and God loves everyone equally. He's not willing that any should perish. So you can see how different that mindset is from the mindset that we see in the Bible of what God desires for his creation. It's totally different. And it shows a real rebellion against God, that whole mindset, in my opinion. We're going to get more into predictive prophecy, but what predictive prophecy does is it shows that randomness is not the driving force in history, that there is something else, because God alone can tell the future and then make the future happen exactly as he said it. And we can prove that he said it long before it happened, because we actually have documents recovered, ancient documents that show that these prophecies were exactly as they are in our modern Bibles. But we'll come back to that more later in the future. Let's look at the next slide. If we know that there's a creator, we've shown logically that there must be a creator, and that this creator is highly, highly intelligent and very powerful. The next question that should be asked is, how can we know him? How can we discover him? We've already shown that the Creator, because of the argument of first cause, the Creator has to be separate from his creation. If he is part of the creation, then the Creator created himself. That's a logical absurdity. If the argument of first cause requires that the Creator be outside of the creation and separate from the creation and greater than the creation itself. Now, we as human beings are confined inside this creation, right? We live in this creation. We are made out of the same material that this creation is, right? We're made out of the dust of the ground. The elements in our body are the elements of chemistry that we have all around us as part of the creation. Therefore, the Creator cannot be discovered by science. It's impossible to discover the Creator by science. Now, why do we say that? Because science is the examination of the material creation. It's the examination of the creation. It is looking at what has been created. But if the Creator is greater than and is apart from and is outside of the creation, then examining the creation is not going to show you the Creator. Now, the creation can imply that there is a Creator, but you're not going to actually find the Creator in the creation logically, unless the Creator decides to come into the creation, right? Which we'll talk about later. But the whole idea that, well, if there's a God, scientists have to discover it, is rubbish. It's rubbish. It's illogical to begin with. It's completely illogical based on these arguments. And these are bulletproof arguments that I've given you. God cannot be discovered by science. Then let me ask you this. Since we're limited to observation, experience, interacting with the material creation, that's what we're limited to as human beings. Can a human being discover God on his own? No.
Well, you have the example of the Jesus face on a potato. You know, those things
yes.
Like that, you know.
Well, let me ask you this then. If we are to discover God, How can we discover God if we can't do it on our own?
He has to introduce himself.
Okay. All right. The only way that the Creator can be discovered is by revelation. And revelation means to reveal himself. He has got to make the effort. See, if it's all our effort trying to discover God, we're never going to find him. But if it is God presenting himself to human beings, then we can find him. Scientific discovery can make inferences about God, but it'll never find God. The Creator cannot create himself. He has to be separate from the universe. Those who scoff at the idea of God because science has not discovered him are using a straw man argument. And you need to point that out. A straw man, what's a straw man argument? Anybody know what a straw man argument is?
You set up an argument that's flimsy and faulty.
It's false. Terrible. You set up an argument that's false and then you shred it to show, look, I tore up that argument. Well, yeah, but the argument was wrong to begin with. All right? That's a straw man argument. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're essentially saying, well, unless science can prove God, I won't believe. Science cannot prove God. Logically, it's impossible for science to prove God. All right, so you're looking in the wrong place. Lastly, on this slide, just from our experience, if there is a Creator who took the trouble to create all this universe that we see, and he took the trouble to design the human body and to design the animals and our food and all these things that we see around us, it's logical to infer from that he would in some way interact with his creation. Isn't that right? That he would interact with it. He had a reason for making all this. There must be a reason for this. And if there's a reason for this, he wants to do something with it. And if he wants to do something with it, we would expect that he would in some way interact with this creation. And therefore, what we should be looking for is possible ways in which the Creator may have interacted in his creation, in history, personally with individuals, and different things like that. Next time, we're going to talk about who is this God. See, we can show, we can prove not only that there is a God, not only that he is highly intelligent and extremely powerful, more than we can possibly imagine in our mind. We can prove that logically. We can also prove who he is, logically, without having to take anything on faith, just because somebody said so. We can prove it logically who that God is. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that we read about in the Bible. We'll talk about that next time, but you have to wait 2 more weeks because I'm going on vacation.